Welcome to Sentient Developments Radio. My name is George Dvorsky, and you are listening to the audio cast of my blog, Sentient Developments, Transhumanist Perspectives on Science, Philosophy, Ethics, and the Future of Intelligent Life. Topics discussed on Sentient Developments Radio include transhumanism,
bioethics,
human enhancement,
the singularity,
accelerating change,
technology,
neuroscience,
cosmology,
catastrophic risk,
existentialism,
spirituality,
philosophy,
science. So sit back, relax, and open your mind to Sentient Developments Radio. You have digitally tuned into Sentient Developments Radio. My name is George Dvorsky. Today is part two of my interview with Dr. James Hughes. Hughes is the executive director of the World Transhumanist Association and the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. And I had the opportunity to interview Dr. Hughes on Saturday, April the 15th. Part one has already been posted on the web, and you can just hit my blog and check for that link. And today I am releasing the second half of this interview. So here is my conversation with James Hughes.
Relatedly, you and I, we are both advocates of world federalism, but I have to admit that I'm as discouraged as ever in regards to ever seeing something like this actually ever take root. And it has been a failed experiment for the last 200 years. And early last century, there was the failed League of Nations, and now it looks like the United Nations is equally stunted in terms of its ability to exert any kind of universal influence over how state actors should work. And even given recent precedents by the United States, who are really de facto policing the world, what are realistically our chances for seeing a world federalism? And of course, if you could just elaborate on why you feel world federalism would be important and how that plays into the tech progressive agenda.
Well, I think that the role of world federalism in the utopian imagination goes back quite a ways, and it just is a logical outgrowth of liberal democracy. The basic notion is that there is no logic to having the nation state as the boundary of our moral imagination and our moral identity. If you are a citizen of the world, as I think most transhumanists consider themselves to be. Most transhumanists don't feel passionate about being Americans or Finns or anything else.
Right.
Something that happens to someone in the Sudan is as of much consequence, perhaps more difficult for you to reach and to influence, but it is as morally consequential as something that happens to another Finn. You don't say, oh, well, that's the Sudanese. They can do whatever the hell they want. And so then the question is, well, what do you do about it? And you should be able to call the police and tell the police my neighbor's getting beaten up or tortured or enslaved, and the police should be able to go to do something about that. And we don't have that police. We don't have the police to call. We don't have a court to go to. We don't have a government to impose taxation to pay for a court or police. And it's just a logical step of human development to create a political structure to enforce global law, protect global human rights, create global public goods such as environmental protection and collective security. So, I think it's in that sense, it's not utopian at all. It's just logical. And in fact, it has always been a part of the parlance of global diplomacy to acknowledge that we need to have those kinds of transnational cooperations and global public goods provided. It's just that they're not willing to give up any of the national sovereignty or national prerogatives that it would be necessary to actually create any of that. So the question is, how do we create sufficient political will to force governments that have their parochial and sectoral interests to give those up and create true transnational authority? I think that, as the challenges, it may be that it will require apocalyptic threats, basically, to create those kinds of authorities. It took World War II, a global near-apocalyptic war, to create the kind of authority to just create the UN itself, which was a wonderful utopian experiment. And I think a lot of us are very pessimistic because it hasn't fulfilled its ambitious goals and our ambitious expectations, but it's a glass half full, glass half empty. We don't know how bad the world would be if there hadn't been a UN, if there hadn't been a World Trade Organization, if there hadn't been a World Bank. Food and Agriculture Organization. All these organizations have done good in the world over the last 60 years, and the question is, how can we get them to be stronger and more politically legitimate, more efficient, to do more good in the future? It may be that these apocalyptic challenges require new transnational agencies. I'd like to see the UN be a directly elected body, and it may be that you have to create a new one and just scrap the old one. But at any rate, I think, you know, it's always astonished me that transhumanists have the ability to imagine uploading their brains into Jupiter-sized computers, but they don't have the ability to imagine a world in which there's a legitimate democratic world state.
I know, I completely sympathize and agree with your concern. But one thing, though, you mentioned that apocalyptic technologies, that they tend, or you're hoping that they will result in a rise of the sense of there being a need for a world federalism. But one could make up the case that that as the threats become more serious, that unilateralism will become more and more seen as a legitimate option. And again, I look at what the United States is doing and what they potentially might do in Iran. And I'm wondering, and my question to you is, let's just hypothesize a bit and say that the United States does in fact go into Iran and manages to wrest their control from their capability in terms of having nuclear weapons, that in a sense that they've actually been its mission accomplished. But I want you to articulate why you feel why is it so bad that you have a unipolar system where you have world power going in and policing, as opposed to, again, a more broadened world federalism or multi-state system in place, transnational systems in place to work.
Well, monarchy is a legitimate stage of political development. It's a stage where a powerful person who controls the majority of force in an area imposes taxes on everyone else and imposes a certain amount of political authority. And to the extent that they are moral in their behavior, they even have some political legitimacy. So, you know, the United States is not the worst world policeman to have. I would far prefer to be under U.S. Imperialism than under Chinese imperialism or Putin's imperialism or Sudanese imperialism. But it is, in the end, completely illegitimate from a democratic point of view to have a body that's elected by 300 million Americans controlling the rest of the 6 billion people on the planet and imposing its police power on that 6 billion. So, I mean, that's just obvious that, you know, we can't continue for political reasons. And so we can't continue also for financial reasons, because the Americans are being bankrupted by this imperial overreach. And that's a pattern that we see all the way back to, you know, the first empires in the Mesopotamia and Sumeria and Rome and Britain and, Holland and all the different empires reached a certain stage of imperial overreach where they were spending more to maintain their empire than they could afford, and it eventually collapses. And when it collapses, the question is, are we going to return to, is somebody else going to take over, some other kind of world power, or are we going to create a true transnational democratic alternative as Europe evolved from monarchies into democracies and now into a transnational democracy? So I think that that's the question that's on the table. There will be some kind of transnational power after the U.S. empire. And the question is, well, will it be democratic and will it be one that we find at all attractive? It's not necessarily going to be, but I would like it to be as attractive as possible.
Do you foresee the situation with the proliferation of nuclear weapons being analogous to the future of the proliferation of other apocalyptic technologies such as molecular assembling nanotechnology? And really what I'm asking is, where could we go wrong today in terms of geopolitics that would lead to potential disaster, let's say 20, 30 years from now?
Well, yes. I think that nuclear proliferation is was the beginning of the set of technology regulation issues. Well, World War One had agreements that grew out of World War One around mustard gas and the use of other kinds of chemical weapons. And even during World War Two, you know, with these horrible regimes that we were fighting, we still didn't redeploy those weapons on the field. Neither side did. And we had certain basic rules of war and the treatment of prisoners of war that were respected. So at any rate, the nuclear weapons, yes, it's been incredibly difficult to get countries to agree to control the proliferation of these weapons. It's been very difficult to identify when countries are actually doing the kind of research and development that is going to develop these weapons. And one of the reasons is that the United States has not fully supported truly reciprocal agreements around the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. We don't want to sign on to agreements that would actually limit what we're doing. And our argument has always been, well, the Russians can sign on to anything they want because they'll just lie about it, but we won't actually lie about it, and therefore we can't sign on to it. Well, you know, from a certain point of view, the Iranians' position today is perfectly understandable, which is, you know, if the United States and the Western powers get to have nuclear weapons, why can't we have nuclear weapons? Right. We're, you know, we're a nation, too. We're part of the nation state system. And the notion that, you know, that you think we're crazy isn't a sufficient legitimation of why we shouldn't have weapons. And that's, you know, true. On the other hand, they are crazy. So they actually they shouldn't have weapons.
Actually, I would beg to differ. I don't think that statement is true. I think the idea of, you know, the idea of sovereignty rights, the idea that just because you are a nation doesn't automatically you know, give justification for the acquisition of those types of weapons.
No, I agree with you, but I'm saying that the United States and Britain and France would all argue that as sovereign nations, they have a right to have their nuclear stockpiles, and nobody should tell them what to do with them.
Right.
And that the so for some reason, then the nuclear club gets to dictate to everyone else who else gets to have weapons, and that's Iran's argument is that, well, if we're playing by nation-state sovereignty rules, then we're a sovereign nation, too. And that's why we need to transcend those nation-state sovereignty rules. We actually need to have sufficient, legitimate transnational authority that says, no, nobody gets to do X.
Right.
And that will set the context. If we can create that kind of an agency, that kind of global power, that will set the context for dealing with the proliferation of dangerous molecular nanotechnology, dangerous artificial intelligence, dangerous bioweapons, and so forth. I mean, we've already had 10, 15 years of efforts to control the proliferation of dangerous bioweapons, and that was one of the reasons why we allegedly invaded Iraq, was because we thought they were also engaged in developing bioweapons. And so, you know, I think, you know, all these issues have been debated and have been in play for quite a while, and we've recently been debating this issue of transnational power on the transhumanist list, and I just find, you know, so many of these libertarian types are completely unaware, completely historically ignorant of what has been happening for the last 50 years in arms control negotiations and international diplomacy. And they just, you know, they hear the word government and their mind turns off. It's crazy.
Right. Now, another one, I know that you've been outspoken in your criticism of the potential weaponization of space. I'm wondering if you wanted to speak about that for a bit.
Well, again, I think it would be a wonderful collective agreement on the part of the countries of the world that we were not going to introduce nukes or other kinds of weaponization into space. It's already been introduced. The U.S. Star Wars system is putting lasers in space and so forth. So, you know, the cat may be already out of the bag, and I don't think that, you know, can continue forever. And the notion of trans-solar political power, I think, is something that's always been a little bit problematic, the notion that we might be able to control what happens on Pluto from a central authority. So in the end, there will be weapons in space, but I think, you know, the question right now is, can we slow it down? It's one of the scenarios, by the way, in Ken MacLeod's science fiction work about how the U.S. starts zapping everybody with lasers from space as one of the ways that we control everyone.
It's interesting. I know that the U.S. Air Force is working on the development of what's been dubbed Starship Troopers, that they've got the idea now that they want to deploy troops literally from space. So I think, as you hinted at earlier, this is a process that's pretty much underway now, and it's largely being, I guess, ignored as an issue, in my mind anyways, in terms of what's being discussed in the media.
Yeah, it's interesting. Cheney recently, six retired U.S. generals called for the resignation of Cheney, largely over his handling of Iraq. But there's a prehistory to this, which is that the Bush administration came into power with the intent to downsize the U.S. military and dramatically reconfigure it into rapid strike small rapid strike, high-tech forces, and they were going to give a lot of money to defense contractors who were going to build the new information and cybernetic systems that would, you know, facilitate this kind of small, lean, mean, clean military action. And then they got sideswiped by the need to send massive troop deployments into Afghanistan and Iraq, and a lot of those plans went off the table. But the U.S. military was pissed off about the Bush administration from the get-go because of this hostile attitude that they had towards guys who basically wanted to see as the status quo maintained, you know, big military forces. And the Bush administration also is against pensions, military pensions, and other things, but and didn't send enough troops into Iraq. A lot of questions that aren't applicable to our interview. But at any rate, I think that there has been a debate in the global military circles about new adaptations of military force to the world that we now live in. And one on the one side, there's the need to send people in rapidly with overwhelming and precise force. And on the other side, there's the need to actually then maintain control and do nation building. And those are two very different tasks. And to the extent that I think that we do need military, I guess I'm on the side of the lean, mean, clean, you know, but I just don't think that, again, it should be the White House deciding whether to send Scud missiles or, you know, cruise missiles into Tehran. It should be the UN Security Council. And then it shouldn't be U.S. Marines trying to do nation building in Kirkuk. It should be blue helmeted Canadian troops. If it has to come to that, at least you guys don't have the same baggage we do.
Jay, I do believe we're running out of time, but I did want to ask you one last thing, and that is the issue of the patenting of human genetic information. And I'm wondering what is it about it that's alarming you, because I know it is, and what are some of your prescriptions for where we need to go in the future to deal with this?
Well, as you know, about 20% of all human genes are now patented, and with the growth of international patent protections under the World Trade Organization, and the protection within the U.S. and within Europe, it's become increasingly difficult for genomic, pharmacogenomic research to be done, because if you want to develop some kind of gene therapy, and it involves a gene that has 20 different patents on it, on the different pieces of the gene or the different gene fragments, it can become a very complicated, expensive, and prohibitive endeavor. So this has become, as you know, in the Marxist left, we used to say, relations of production are holding back the means of production. We aren't able to develop the science and technology because property relations have gotten in the way. So the other argument is that, you know, this is absurd, that, you know, it's absurd to allow people to go out and say, here's a mountain. I'm going to patent this mountain. I discovered this mountain and I'm patenting it. Well, the U.S. Patent Office, and for some reason, even the Europeans, who should have more sense on this, have said when you decode a gene, that it's suddenly an invention as opposed to a discovery. Well, that's absurd, because in 10 years, we're all going to be carrying things in our pocket, which will be able to decode all of our genes and read them out into our PDA, just the same way that they did 10 years ago with this multi-billion-dollar effort around the world. And then, okay, well, what do I do with this information? You mean you own this piece of information I just read out of my own cell and that I share with every other human being on the planet? Well, what does that mean? I can't cook, you know, a new baby with this piece of gene because you own it somehow or you have a patent on it. Now, where it really gets problematic from a transhumanist point of view is that if I then what you should be able to patent is things that's invented, a true actual invention. Somebody comes up with an artificial chromosome that's going to make me live for another 100 years, and I buy it and I stick it in my body. And then I want to have children, and my children are going to inherit this, and they come along and say, I'm sorry, that's an infringement of your patent rights. You have to pay us a commission or a license fee to have children. Well, that's absurd. So we really need to rethink the entire patent regime around the control of genes. I don't have any problem with the patenting of non-citizen beings. So the patenting of novel animal creations. You know, if you want to make a new kind of mouse, I think that's okay. But when you put patents into living, conscious citizens, they should get to own all the genes in their body and basically abrogate the patent rights of somebody else. And I don't think you should be able to patent discovery genes. So those are the two areas where I'm most concerned.
Are those definite agendas for you to pursue with both the WTA and the IET?
I think that's more of an IET issue because it's a real wonky issue. I don't find very many people in the transhumanist circles who have two thoughts to rub together about intellectual property law. So I do think that we need to address it, and I do think that the IET needs to address it, and I think it will be increasingly on the table, but it's not something you're going to see banners unfurled in the streets about.
Okay. Jay, thank you for speaking with me today, and I certainly hope that this will be the first of perhaps many conversations over the next few months on Sentient Developments Radio. You're going to be speaking at Stanford University in May. What specifically are you going to be speaking about?
I'm working on a new book called Cyborg Buddha, which is the theme of which is how we can use neurotechnologies to enhance human virtue, to become more moral, compassionate, patient, better people. And that pushes a lot of people's buttons. So I'm going to present on one of the cognitive enhancement panels about the basic idea of that there are many neurotechnologies that we have now and that are coming in the future which allow us to be better people.
I very much look forward to that. Again, thank you, Jay, for being on the show today, and have a good evening.
You too.
That concludes my interview with the WTA's and IEET's Dr. James Hughes. Look for future interview with Simon Smith, the editor-in-chief of Better Humans, and also look for my podcast of the recent Toronto Transhumanist Association event in which Dr. Mark Walker spoke about super longevity. So until then, everyone, have a great evening. Bye-bye.